Glaube an Schwund fehlt schon mal. Thank you. Okay, normal question. Who was not here this morning? Wow. Okay, thank you. I know some of you were ministering elsewhere or other parts of this church or other parts of the area. So particularly for you, but not only for you, I want to just bring us all up to speed with what we're looking at. And then we're going to round off. I was asked to do about four sessions, 20, 25 minutes each. So we're going to be okay for time. I may just talk a little bit longer. But we are looking at this strange chapter. Strange because of its content and strange because of its context. We've said now three times already that this chapter is bookended by two other chapters which show us an incredible side of David. David's kindness and grace and wisdom and gentleness towards Saul when he has two opportunities to kill Saul. But God has obviously spoken powerfully to David. And the truth is alive in David. I will never raise my hand against the Lord's anointed. In other words, the king of Israel. Either he'll just grow old and die, or he'll be ill, or he'll die in battle. But it's not my responsibility to kill him. David has seen that clearly. And yet in this chapter, chapter 25, he obviously has not seen clearly how completely unacceptable to God it is to slaughter innocent people. Now, it's bad enough killing Nabal, because Nabal has slighted David and his men. But to make this vow, may God deal with me, be it ever so severely. In other words, may God kill me. If there is one man of Nabal's household alive this time tomorrow. These men were innocent. These men didn't agree with Nabal. And yet David has gone off on one and he's determining to kill all of the men of Nabal's household. And so we said we're looking at this whole subject of blind spots. Of having an area in my life where I just don't see what lots of other people can see very clearly. And so we looked at the reality of blind spots. We said that they affect individuals. David, of course, an individual. We said they affect Christian leaders. David is described as a man after God's own heart. He's the future king of Israel. He's an awesome guy. And yet he has this area, and many other areas of his life, actually, which are completely out of phase with the character and heart of God. And then we said that blind spots affect groups of people. There are 600 people who buy into David's bad reaction. We said that blind spots affect churches. They affect movements. They affect streams of people. And therefore there is a high likelihood that Hebron, along with every other local church, perhaps the stream of evangelical Christianity, has blind spots that we don't recognize. The nature of a blind spot is you don't know what you don't know. You don't know that you don't know something. Secondly, we looked at the reasons for blind spots. And we said, let's build a bridge from the physical areas that we're fully aware of, which may serve as an illustration, as a transition into a realm that we may not be quite so clear about. That's what Jesus did in his parables. He would tell a story that people felt comfortable with and they thought they understood it, and then he would encourage them to go away and think about it and apply it. And so we said in the physical realm, why do we have blind spots? And we looked at the nature of our eye and said that in every eye there is a blind spot where the optic nerve leaves the retina. And we had a little experiment last week to illustrate the blind spot. So the very way that we are made, the way that we are hardwired as people, can cause us not to see certain things. Secondly, we talked about the whole concept of being programmed. And that if we've looked at something a certain way for a long time, it is extraordinarily difficult to see it from a different point of view. I've looked at this, I've thought about this, I've analysed this, I've processed this. And the moment that somebody begins to say, well, there's another way of looking at this, it's very difficult for us to do that. So the way we are hardwired, the way we already look at things. Thirdly, we talked about our potential to think we're looking at something, but we're not looking at it. We talked about a blind spot on a car and how we can think that we have looked at all of the area behind us and alongside us. But there is an area that we have not seen. We think we've seen it, but we haven't. And so often when I listen to our students debate about areas in which theologians for 2,000 years have disagreed, it's a dialogue of the deaf. People are not actually listening to what the other person is saying. I'm so convinced I'm right and you're wrong that actually when you're talking to me, what's going on inside of my brain is, la 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 la, I'm not listening to what you're saying, I'm just waiting for you to pause for breath and I'm going to leap in and correct you. A blind spot. And then this morning, we looked at the fact that some things are concealed, some things are covert, some things are hidden. And we said, especially in warfare, things that are exceedingly dangerous can fly in below the radar or can be invited in through the city gates because it looks like a big horse. And we don't realize that the thing is hiding and masking stuff that's going to destroy us. And then we ended this morning, and I have to show these again because those who are not here this morning will not have a sweet clue what we were talking about. And I know that some of you have not watched anything on the TV this afternoon. You've done nothing but wrestle with this all afternoon, maybe. Somebody just gave me a puzzle tonight, and you've no idea the self-discipline it took for me not to think about that puzzle but to enter into the worship. Here are four men. They're buried up to their neck in sand. I'm not going to give you all the details from this morning. Is there a problem with this? Sorry? It's my end somewhere. Okay, wow. Don't know where that is. Let me try one more time. What I'll do is, please forgive me a moment, guys. I shall start again with this. Do you mind if I reboot it? There you go. Bingo. Don't know what happened there. Woo! Is that on now? Not on now? Okay, thank you. That's great. Thanks a lot. Here's the picture that we looked at this morning. Four gentlemen with hats. They are buried up to their neck in sand. They can't speak to each other. They know there are two black hats and two red hats, but they do not know the color of hat on their own head. They were all blindfolded when the hats were placed on their heads. And the guy gives them 5 minutes, the man who's running the contest, and he says, I want one of you, using logic alone, to tell me the color of hat on your head. Absolutely, 100% for certain. You're not allowed to talk to anybody else. If you get it wrong, you're all dead. If you refuse to take the thing, you're all dead. That was the first question this morning. And then the second question was, here is a country in which anything that is sent through the mail that is not in a locked container, anything that's not in a locked container will be stolen. And here's a man who wants to send an engagement ring to his fiancée, and he has as many metal boxes as you want. The metal boxes each have hinged lids, and on the end of the lid is a hasp that comes down, a loop that comes down. It goes over another loop sticking out of the side of the box. He puts a padlock through and locks it. You have to have a key to lock the padlock. You have to have the same key to unlock the padlock. The man has as many boxes and as many padlocks as you want. But each padlock has a unique key. So he puts the ring in the box, he closes the lid, he puts the padlock through the hasp, locks it, sends it to his fiancée. How does she open the box and get the ring out? She has as many boxes and unique padlocks with unique keys as you want. So they can be sending these boxes and boxes in boxes and all the rest of it backwards and forwards. Okay, some things are complicated. When I tell you the answer to that, you may well kick yourself. It is very, very simple. But until somebody tells you, it is a blind spot. You can't see it. And quite honestly, there are things in Scripture that are crystal clear when you see them. But quite honestly, it's like pulling teeth trying to get somebody to see it until they see it. So if you're not going to listen to anything else I say now, but that's why the rest are back tonight. All right. And then here's the next thing that we looked at this morning. We looked at the repercussions of blind spots. And we said that one of the tragedies of blind spots are they stop us growing in that area. We don't change in that area. If I don't know that I don't know something, I'm not trying to find the solution to it. And so David is remaining the worst version of David in this area of his life until he's alerted to the blind spot. Saul was never alerted to his blind spot. Saul is living in a parallel universe. Saul is living in a virtual reality. He is absolutely certain that David is trying to kill him. He's certain that all of his men are colluding with David and Jonathan. None of you have told me that the son of Jesse has made a covenant with my son Jonathan. None of you have told me that he's lying in wait for me to this very day. That was completely, utterly, totally wrong. But Saul was convinced he was absolutely right. Question, I wonder in your life if there are areas where you are absolutely certain you are right and you are actually completely and utterly wrong. And you don't even suspect it. So this whole area of blind spots is very, very important. Okay, that's where we got to this morning. And I promise you that I will give you the answers to those puzzles in a few minutes. So let's have a look at the rationalization of blind spots. Or the rationalizing of blind spots. And the first thing to recognize, as we mentioned a moment ago, is that people who have blind spots don't recognize it or suspect it. That's the problem. Now, some of you may be horrified that I listened to this person in the past. If you're horrified, please just put it on one side for now. Right? I don't appreciate this person's language. I don't appreciate some of the things they say. But I saw an interview with Billy Connolly. And he was talking about something that happened in his life. And he was using a couple of illustrations. And I thought, does he not realize the incredible blind spot he has? He was talking about, as a performer, how annoying it is when somebody has a mobile phone. And he was talking about the complexities of getting the attention of an audience and holding their attention and kind of eye to eye, relating to everyone, and how hard it is to build that and how easy it is for that to be lost. And as somebody who speaks a lot to lots of people, I was identifying with that, absolutely. It just needs one person in a meeting like this to stand up and go out to the loo, and I promise you, you lose the attention of 15, 20 people. And now you've got to tell a little joke or say what you said just to get everybody backing. So I'm listening to this, and I identified and understand that he was very, very angry when that happened when he was performing. And then he told a story about going into a pub in England, a pub restaurant, when they had just introduced the no smoking rules. And how he likes a cigar. And he was talking about being in a bar with two of his friends, and he's smoking a cigar, one of those has a cigarette, and some people come through from the restaurant and begin to complain to him that the smoke from his cigar and his friend's cigarette is annoying them. And how ticked off he was that they would come and begin to tell him what you're doing is annoying us. And I'm thinking, this guy is an intelligent guy. Can he not join up the dots? Can he not see that just as it is inappropriate for people to mess up what he's doing with hundreds of people who've paid to be there, does he not see how inappropriate it is for him to mess up scores of people in a restaurant who've paid to be there, and he just wants to smoke anyway and couldn't care less what he... Blind spots, I mean, it's easy from the outside to see somebody's blind spot, but when you're in the middle of it, it's very, very, very difficult. I wonder how many of us believe that we are totally objective. I look at situations, I analyze situations, I look at the evidence, I have a very good mind, and so my conclusion by definition is absolutely correct. None of us are totally objective. That's the whole point. I heard a man a while ago say this: the only true objectivity is subjectivity that is completely self-aware. I know I'm subjective. I know there are things about me that are not objective. My past, my history, my experiences, my culture, where I was brought up, how I've been programmed, how I've done life, how I respond, how I react. I am not completely objective. There's stuff about me I understand, there's stuff about me I don't understand, and all of that fuels the conclusions I arrive at. With respect, if you don't recognize that statement is true of you, you are illustrating the very thing that we're looking at, a blind spot. We are all subjective. The moment you put I in a sentence, you are introducing a lot of stuff in addition to objectivity. That's why you can get brilliant scientists who look at exactly the same data and come up with completely opposite conclusions. One person comes up with a conclusion there is a creator, and all of this evidence points towards that. Somebody else comes up with a conclusion there is not a creator, and all the evidence points to that. It's not the evidence that's leading them in different directions. It's the non-objective data that each of them is subject to that's leading them in different directions. People who have blind spots don't recognize it. By definition, people who have blind spots are convinced that they're right. David is convinced he's right to react as he does to Nabal. And so as I look at the news and I see some terrorists who are doing indescribably wicked things, perhaps if I was born in their culture and brought up with their problems, I'd see these same people as freedom fighters. See, so often we look at things but don't realize that we are looking at them through lenses. We're filtering things out. We're exaggerating things. We're minimizing things. And we all do this. And so here you have Saul of Tarsus in the New Testament. And Saul is a religious person. And Saul reads his Bible probably more than anybody in this room. And Saul prays and is committed to Yahweh in a way that was burning off his associates. He describes himself as a Pharisee of the Pharisees. And as people are taking an innocent man called Stephen, and they are stoning him to death. And stoning was not having somebody over there and picking up little stones like kids do at the beach and kind of throwing them at the person. Stoning somebody was holding them down with their head on a rock and picking up another boulder and smashing their skull in. It was horrendous. It was a bloody exercise. And yet Saul, supposedly obeying Yahweh, is looking at this and is basically applauding what is happening to Stephen. People who have blind spots are convinced they're right. And other elements of humanity like gentleness and tenderness and, boy, this can't be right to treat somebody like this. And so you have John Calvin, whom I greatly respect. But John Calvin disagrees with a man called Servetus. And John Calvin has Servetus burned to death over green wood so that he will suffer for his heresy. People who have blind spots may have Bibles. People who have blind spots may have incredibly strong religious opinions. Doesn't mean they're right. And it's incredible how people who have blind spots can excuse their blind spots. It's really great being at Cape Maria. I love it. Crazy to everybody except them. Now, David, if he'd hired an attorney, and this had been one of these Judge Judy things that you see on the TV or whatever, And there's a big trial where the evidence is presented on either side. David's attorney could have put forward a very, very strong case for what David was doing. So, for instance, Nabal apparently owes David a large amount of money. We said this morning we have to fill in the gaps because all the evidence is not there in the text. But listen to what David says, chapter 25, verse 21. As Abigail comes riding towards him, David had just said, "It has been useless, all my watching over this fellow's property in the desert, so that nothing of his was missing. He has paid me back evil for good." So it seems that David and his men have in some ways been guarding the herds and flocks of Nabal. It seems as though Nabal doesn't know about this arrangement, so that's the bit that's a bit complicated, but certainly from David's point of view. And then chapter 25, verse 7. "Now I hear that it is sheep shearing time." This is when David sends his men, or he's talking to his men about getting money from Nabal. "When your shepherds were with us, we did not ill-treat them, and the whole time they were at Carmel, nothing of theirs was missing." And Nabal's men agree with that evaluation. Not Nabal, but his men. The men who David's planning to kill. Verse 15. "These men were very good to us. They did not ill-treat us. And the whole time we were out in the fields near them, nothing went missing. Night and day, they were a wall around us all the time we were herding our sheep near them." And so, there's obviously been some kind, either specific or implied, contract. Nabal can afford to pay David, and now is the time to do it. It says, chapter 25, verse 2, "A certain man in Maon who had property there at Carmel was very wealthy. He had 1,000 goats and 3,000 sheep, which he was shearing in Carmel." So in his culture, he is the CEO of a mega company. And later on in the text, verse 36, "When Abigail went to Nabal, he was in the house holding a banquet like that of a king. He was in high spirits and was very, very drunk." So certainly money is owed to David, and certainly Nabal can afford to pay it. Here's the third thing that David's attorney would be presenting as evidence: that Nabal has reneged on this deal and is acting like a jerk, like an idiot. Verse 9, "When David's men arrived, they gave Nabal this message in David's name." Isn't this interesting? "Then they waited." It seems as though Nabal just keeps them waiting. Here's this guy who is exercising his right and is implying, "I'm important, you're unimportant, I'll deal with you when I get round to it." He keeps them waiting. And then verse 10, "Nabal answered David's servants," who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? That's what Saul keeps calling David, the son of Jesse. "Many servants are breaking away from their masters these days. Why should I take my bread and water and the meat I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men coming from who knows where?" This is incredibly dismissive of the future king of Israel. Verse 14. "One of the servants told Nabal's wife, Abigail, 'David sent messengers from the desert to give our master his greetings, but he hurled insults at them.'" In Hebrew, that verb is the picture of a bird screeching as it's tearing its victims to pieces. He was shrieking at them. He was abusive towards them. And then in verse 39, "When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, 'Praise be to the Lord, who has upheld my cause against Nabal for treating me with contempt.'" And so David could make a very strong case for why he's feeling hurt, why he's feeling abused, and why he is responding as he was responding. Nevertheless, David would still have been wrong if he had killed every male. He says later on when he's talking to Abigail, the Lord has kept his servant from doing wrong and has brought Nabal's wrongdoing down on his own head. So this is what is so frightening about blind spots. Not only do we not know we have them, but sometimes if we are challenged on them by the wrong person at the wrong time in the wrong way, wow, their head is about to leave their shoulders as we give them what for. So I thought we should close by looking at perhaps the most important thing of all, which is the recognition of blind spots. And at the risk of repeating myself, it is very, very, very hard to recognize our own blind spots. And actually is literally a work of God. I personally feel, and I may be biased, but I personally feel that most Christians do not have a sweet clue how hard it is to change our mind. I don't mean on a shallow level. I mean on a profoundly deep level. I've seen this so often. Maybe you can just kind of fade this out for a moment. I believe that is a very wise statement. I believe there's a huge amount of truth in that statement. Absolutely. I know why that statement is there. That statement is there to guard against imaginative, emotional, getting words from God every 30 seconds kind of people. God's called me, God's shown me, this happened, met an angel, I glow in the dark, I swing from the chandeliers, God's showing me, God's leading me, brother, so you follow me. I understand where the statement's coming from. I just don't think it's a thoroughly biblical statement, that's all. I think it's a great statement. Build your experience on your theology. There's a problem with that statement. What if your theology has got some blind spots? What's going to happen then? Oh, well, you study the Bible, brother, and God will correct you. Oh, really? Is that what sorted David out? Did somebody kind of drop down a little tract from heaven and he read it and it sorted him out? Not at all. Here is Saul of Tarsus who studies the Bible. The problem is he studies the Bible through his programming, his first century Pharisaistic programming. So he exaggerates some truths in the Bible, he minimizes other truths in the Bible, and other statements in the Bible may as well not be there. So if you went to Saul of Tarsus with a Bible in your hand and tried to prove to him that Jesus was the Messiah, you would either be dead or thrown into prison. No amount of Bible teaching would correct Saul of Tarsus's theology, which was shot through with blind spots. I know I shared this with you 3 times ago as well. Here is Simon Peter, who quotes on the day of Pentecost that God is going to pour his Spirit out on all flesh, on different people groups. Simon Peter quotes that from the prophet Joel, but is not prepared to cross the road to talk to a non-Jew. And for 10 chapters of the book of Acts, actively stays away from non-Jewish people. And if you quoted Joel to Simon Peter, he'd agree with you. Yes, 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 yes. Yes, I know it's in the Bible. Yes, yes, isn't that wonderful? Great. But it doesn't change his programming. It doesn't change his blind spot. And so Saul of Tarsus has to have an experience, an encounter, not just sitting down with a book and reading it. He meets Jesus on the road to Damascus, and he addresses his blind spot. So now he goes back to the same Bible and sees all over the Bible the truth that's been there all along, but to him is a blind spot. That the Messiah would be rejected, the Messiah would be killed, the Messiah would raise again on the 3rd day. That's in the scriptures. That's what he then goes on to preach. But he's never seen it because of his blind spot. So he has an experience that fills out his theology. Similarly, Simon Peter on the rooftop has an experience when the blanket comes down and God says to him, newsflash, I'm sending a software update. Rise, Peter, kill and eat. And the blanket's full of all the animals is full of animals, all of which are listed in Leviticus as not being correct to eat. And Simon begins to have an exegetical debate with Yahweh about what this text means. And I've never eaten stuff like this. See, just studying the Bible on its own does not get rid of our blind spots. Because they're so powerful, they're so hard to get rid of, even to recognize. I read a statement that haunted me. You remember the Titanic? The Titanic is unsinkable. When you look at the data about the Titanic sinking, they were getting warnings about icebergs for hours. And somebody spoke about the captain of the Titanic, 30 years of experience, was working against him. 30 years of, I know what I'm doing, I've researched this, I know all about this ship, I know all about navigation, I know about icebergs in this area, etc., etc., etc. Massive blind spot. So notice how much emphasis is placed in the text on God speaking to David to alert him to his blind spot. Let me just read you a few. Chapter 25, verse 26. Now, since the Lord has kept you, my master, from bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hands, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, may your enemies and all who intend to harm my master be like Nabal. The Lord has kept you. Or verse 32, David said to Abigail, praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you today to meet me. God sent you, Abigail, to talk to me. Or verse 34, otherwise, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has kept me from harming you. God stopped me harming you, Abigail. Or verse 39, when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, praise be to the Lord who has upheld my cause against Nabal for treating me with contempt. He has kept his servant from doing wrong and has brought Nabal's wrongdoing down on his own head. Then David sent word to Abigail asking her to become his wife. So I wonder if we recognize about ourselves, I will have blind spots. I don't know I have them. It is next door to impossible for me to figure out what they are. Actually, it will take a work of God to alert me to that. Now, perhaps most of us are reasonably happy with that. How about this? Almost always, we need somebody else to help us to see them. By definition, we need somebody else to speak into our life. Now, if this was Bible school, I'd get you all into small groups for the next half hour, and I'd ask you to do a study on Abigail to see why God chose her to speak to David. And it's fascinating. It's absolutely brilliant what God used in Abigail to get David's attention. I mean, she's gorgeous, according to David later on. She's a beautiful woman. She's very intelligent. She's very, very, very smart in the way that she comes to him. It's just great that God chooses the person and the time and the method. Look at what she does. Verse 18. Abigail lost no time. She took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 dressed sheep, 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 cakes of raisins, and 200 cakes of pressed figs, and loaded them on donkeys. Then she told her servants, go on ahead, I'll follow you. So here's David, as angry as a wasp, coming down the mountainside, and all of this food starts arriving. You know, it comes in waves. Where's all this coming from? Where's all this coming from? Where's all this coming from? And then at the back of all this stuff, suddenly Abigail rides along. Look what it says, verse 23. When Abigail saw David, she quickly got off her donkey and bowed down before David with her face to the ground. Do you think she's a threat to David? Not at all. In their culture, she's coming to him in the role of a servant and just bowing to the floor. Verse 41, she bowed down with her face to the ground. This is when she's coming to be his wife. And said, here is your maidservant, ready to serve you and wash the feet of my master's servants. If you look at the text, she calls David my Lord 14 times. She refers to herself as his servant 6 times. This is an incredible model in how to approach a guy who's high on testosterone, who's ready to kill somebody. It is just so beautiful the way that she comes and talks to him. What an awesome woman Abigail is. Let me just tell you a story. This is going back a long, long time. This is when British Rail were going down the tubes. And so two of their directors book an appointment with one of the leading marketing and advertising agencies in London, Saatchi & Saatchi. And they go along there with the view of, we want to relaunch British Rail. And we want you to do that for us. So they have an appointment at 9 o'clock. They arrive at 5 to 9. And the woman who's on reception is chewing gum. And she says to them, if you could just sit there, please. They'll send for you in a minute. And she leaves them sitting there for 20 minutes. These guys are not used to being kept waiting for 20 minutes. So after 20 minutes, one of them marches up to the desk. She's in a back room somewhere. Bing, bing, bing rings as she comes out. Yeah, what do you want? We had an appointment 20 minutes. Oh, yeah, they'll be out in a minute. Can I get you a drink? One of them said, I'd like a coffee, please. One of them said, I'd like a cup of tea, but with no milk. Sure. She disappears. 10 minutes later, she comes out with the wrong coffee, with the wrong kind of tea, and it's all slushed all over the sauce and slams it in front of them and disappears again. These guys are just so angry. And they're about to march out, and on the way out, they can hear laughter, and they look back and they see all the doors that open onto the central area. There are people peeping through them. At which point, one of the directors of Saatchi & Saatchi walks out and says, I'm really sorry that you had to go through that. Really sorry that you received horrendous service. Sorry that you asked for things that you didn't get, you got promises that weren't kept. But we wanted you for 25 minutes to experience what your customers experience every day. Now let's talk about relaunching British Rail. We want you to experience what it's like on this side of the table. I wonder if you've ever thought about this. Maybe the best person to show you your blind spot is somebody on the receiving end of your behavior fueled by your blind spot. You not to be looking at somebody else, you don't know them, you've never eyeballed them, you've never sat down with them, you don't know their story, you don't know what it's like to be them, but you have an incredibly strong attitude towards them. I'll kill them if I get anywhere near them. And then one day you sit down with one of them who relates to you, listen to this, and who you connect to. David connected to Abigail. For probably a lot of, she's a woman. She's kind of humbling herself in front of me. She looks really nice. She's kind of smart. You know what, I wouldn't mind marrying her. And David's off on another testosterone-fueled little expedition in his brain. Somebody he connects to, and somebody who's on the receiving end of the behavior fueled by his blind spot. And suddenly David sees things from a completely different point of view. What an awesome woman Abigail was. The final thing I wanted to flag up was that we really need to listen in order to suspect that we may have blind spots and see what they are and where they are. There is a tremendous emphasis in this chapter on listening, also on not listening. So, she fell at his feet and said, my Lord, let the blame be on me alone. Please let your servant speak to you. Please hear what your servant has to say. Please listen to what I'm trying to say. Verse 25, may my Lord pay no attention to that wicked man Nabal. He's just like his name. His name is Fool, and folly goes with him. But as for me, your servant, I didn't see the men that my master sent. And then David accepted from her hand what she brought to him and said, go home in peace. I have heard your words. I've actually listened to what you're saying. How about Nabal? These are the men of Nabal speaking to Abigail. Now think it over and see what you can do, because disaster is hanging over our master and his whole household. He's such a wicked man that no one can talk to him. No one can talk to him because he doesn't listen to anybody. Can I ask you some questions? To whom have you given the right to speak into your life? To whom have you said, I will not become defensive and I will not become aggressive. Can you tell me one area of my life that would make life better for you if I was to change it? Is there anybody you've ever said that to? Let me ask you as a church, who have you invited to say, look, from the outside, this is where we see your blind spots. This is where we see the things that you can't see in the middle of the group. Who would that be? I wanted to just give you the answer to those questions before we move on to something else. They really are simple, I promise you. The only man who can say for sure what colour hat he has on is the man in the middle at the back. And the reason he can tell you is because the man behind him doesn't say anything. All right? So the man in the middle is looking at the man in front of him and knows he's got a black hat on. So the guy behind can see my hat and the hat of the man in front. He knows there are two black hats in the equation. If I had a black hat on, says the man in the middle, and the man in front of me had a black hat on, then the man behind us would shout, I've got a red hat on, because he would see two black hats. The fact that he's not saying anything, he's telling me he's seeing a red hat and a black hat, so he doesn't know what he's got on. So I must have a red hat on. Simple, eh? Here's the next one. I love this one. Somebody rang me this afternoon and got the answer, which was great. You don't need all of those boxes and those padlocks. Never assume with a problem that you need all the stuff you're given. Not all of it's important. Just let me say something, by the way, in brackets. I wonder if some of you, with respect, saying, this stuff's stupid. Who cares? Who could give a flying rip about this stuff? Silly things. I haven't got time for them. With respect, that's a massive blind spot. Do you know some of the greatest discoveries on this planet were made by people playing games who saw a principle and then applied it to something else? These things are classic illustrations of lateral thinking, where linear thinking, you can think about it all day and you'll never sort it out. If you go sideways and approach it a different way, suddenly you see something. Here's what the man does. He gets the ring, he puts it in a box, he closes the lid, puts the hasp down, puts a padlock, locks it. Sends it through the post to his fiancée. She can't open it because she doesn't have a key, does she? So what she does is get one of her padlocks, put her padlock also through the hasp and locks it. So now it's got two padlocks on. And it's sent back through the post to her fiancé. He undoes his padlock. Now there's only one padlock locked, hers. Sends it back to her. She opens her padlock. Bingo. Engaged. Result. It's dead simple when you see it. But it is very difficult to see it until somebody tells you. We often need someone else's help in understanding things. I wanted to close by showing you something that my really good friend Ken Fearon, showed me. And just to get us into this, maybe you can kill this again if that's okay. Bob has finally gone over the edge. We've suspected it for a while. He's been right on the edge of this convex slope. Now he's disappeared. He's joined Hare Krishna or something. We've suspected it. Well, Joe Hare is not some kind of Indian mystical thing. It's actually named after two researchers at the University of California, Los Angeles. Yeah, I thought so. Joseph Luft and Harrington Ingham. And they came up with the Joe Hare, the Joe and Hare window. And it's dead simple. It's not complicated. It has two axes. And the left-hand vertical axis is things about me that are known to other people. And then the horizontal axis is things that are known to me about me. This is all about me. You read it, it's about you as an individual. So there are obviously four quadrants. The top left-hand quadrant is the things about me that I know about me and you know about me. So that's an area where I am open, and the person you are dealing with is the real me, and I recognize that, and we get on great. The bottom left-hand corner is stuff about me that I know about me that you don't, because I've not told you. And that's the area of my life that is hidden from you. And so there'll be times when I respond and react and it just doesn't compute with the person that you see. Why does Rob react like that when we start talking about this? Well, it's weird. What's that about? And then the bottom right-hand corner is things about me that I don't know and things about me that you don't know. They are unknown areas of my life, unknown to me and unknown to you. And the top right-hand quadrant is what we've been talking about for the last 3 weeks. It's the things about me that I don't know, but you do know. You see them so clearly. Could I suggest, you can turn the thing back on, you probably have already, I don't know. Could I suggest, and I'm not picking on that church, could I suggest that in that church and many churches and many groups and many businesses and many movements and many streams, we tend to think that the way that we're going to get sorted out is only by reading the Bible, probably on our own, is only by praying, probably on our own, is only by going to conferences, probably just sitting and listening. And the harsh reality is that many of those areas do not yield to those three things. They just don't. So let's close by looking at how the open area of my life can get bigger. And it can get bigger in three ways. First of all, the unknown areas of my life. The areas of me that I don't understand, I'm not in touch with, I don't fully understand, you don't know about them, only God knows about them. They require the activity of God to lead me and to give me revelation and to teach me and to show me. And maybe that's an area that we're fairly comfortable with. Well, it's God doing it. But how about the hidden area of my life? How about me developing a small group of dear friends for whom I take the mask off and I say, this is what I'm struggling with. This is the real me, not the religious me. This is what I can't work through. This is what's keeping me awake at night. This is what I don't understand about me. I become vulnerable and I open more of myself to a small number of people. And that becomes a very therapeutic and a very healing thing. But how about the blind spot area? The blind spot area is the top right-hand corner where I actively invite people I trust to give me input about what they see in my life that could change. Could I, with respect, suggest that lots of evangelical Christians can go on for 15, 20, 30 years and not change in significant areas because we're not using all of the methods of growth that the Bible illustrates and modern researchers simply put down in a little diagram like that? So here's the question, so what? So what? Rob, thanks for coming. Thank you so much for coming for 3 weeks. So what? So what is going to change as a result of the last 3 weeks? What personally are you going to do differently as a result of this teaching? One of my best friends is Jim Graham, who some of you know. And Jim and I sit down and Jim said, Rob, you and I are not into nice little talks. We're fed up of giving nice little talks. We actually want to see people's lives changed. You remember the advert for the lottery that was on the TV? Everybody sits there thinking, I'll never win the lottery. And then there's a big hand comes through the ceiling. Yoo-hoo! You won. Well, here's the deal. God is saying now to each one of us, Now it's over to you. What are you going to do differently as a result of this teaching on blind spots? Who are you going to invite into your life to give you wisdom and help along the future path of following Jesus? Because if you don't, guess what? In 10, 15, 20 years, you'll still have people who every time they open their mouth, put the foot in it. And every time they open their mouth, say something ludicrous. And everybody else is trying not to laugh. He dropped dead completely healthy. And they don't even suspect it. Let's pray together. Father, thank you.